Hello and welcome to Prehistory, the archaeology of the ancient Near East, with me, Jane. I've been pretty unwell for a little while, and I know that I've been neglecting you. I'm up and about more now, and I've left you waiting long enough for the end of the pre-pottery Neolithic. So today, I'm going to talk to you about what has been most often referred to as the PPNB collapse. Over the last few episodes, we've been talking about the pre-pottery Neolithic. We've seen how hunter-gatherers of the late Epipaleolithic started to settle down into villages, either for a few months at a time or more permanently throughout the year. We saw how they started to manage stands of wild plants that were growing around these villages, and how this changed a lot of these plants over time into the domesticated forms, which form the basis for a lot of the domestic plant crops that we eat today. We saw similarly how people in different parts of the Near East started to put more control over wild animals. First dogs, long before the start of the Neolithic, but in the Neolithic, starting to control food animals. This started probably with sheep and goats, and later on, people also kept and raised cattle and pigs. These animals also changed over time. They lived close to humans, they got smaller, and they became bigger and bigger portions of the animal diet of human groups across the Near East. Although in most places, people still hunted other animals to some degree, such as gazelle and deer. These villages, and the people living in them, also changed over the course of the pre-pottery Neolithic. Houses got more complicated, and varied in shape and design across different regions. Villages also got communal buildings, either granaries, areas to socialize in and perform rituals, or some combination of these. As some sites got larger, more than one of these public buildings might turn up in a single site, suggesting that societies were starting to organize themselves into subgroups, such as extended kinship groups or clans. Things also moved around, and moved around more over time. We see shells and stone beads moving around the Near East, often over really long distances. We also see raw materials like obsidian moving around over long distances. And over the course of the PPNB, we saw some of the largest sites, the megasites, seeming to have either better access to these traded goodies or possibly even having some sort of control over the movement of goods around the landscape. Of course, nothing stays the same forever. And about 7,000 Cal BCE, or about 9,000 years ago, this pattern of PPNB life changed. These changes are what we often call the PPNB collapse. But was this a collapse? When I hear the word collapse, I usually think of disaster films, with people running in the street and screaming as fireballs rain down from the sky. Well, this was definitely not that kind of collapse. That is, at least, one thing that all of us archaeologists can agree on. Probably. The idea of a collapse dates back a few decades, and is something that was most intensively looked at in the Levant, although it was something that was talked about for most of the Near East as well. What we used to know about the Neolithic in the Near East was that we had these lovely big megasites, and a range of smaller sites, and then at some point, about 7,000 Cal BCE, these disappeared. Then, at least in the southern Levant, we had a gap. And after a few hundred years, we saw a new pattern of small farming villages dotted around the landscape which had pottery. Because, as we've been talking for a while about the pre-pottery Neolithic, it is probably no real surprise that the next part of the Neolithic that we're going to talk about is the pottery Neolithic. Yes, it's not really very imaginative naming, but I think that by now you might have worked out that we are not particularly inventive at coming up with names for time periods or cultures. Anyway, we had the end of the PPNB and a gap, and then we had pottery Neolithic villages. This led to a debate about what happened, and why the whole system of the PPNB had vanished, or collapsed, and that it had taken a while for societies to get going again. There were a couple of arguments to explain why this might have happened. Namely, that the climate had shifted and that there had been a long drought, and that people had needed to go on the move as mobile pastoralists, people who move around with their animal herds and mostly live off of them, or that people had stripped the landscape around PPNB settlements so badly that they'd had to move on to somewhere else. And for both arguments, that the landscape just couldn't support big groups of people anymore for a while. Well, this wasn't exactly a nice and tidy theory, but what it has in common with so many of the nice and tidy theories that we've seen already is that we did more excavations and we discovered that we were wrong. There was no gap. With time and with more research, and with getting more absolute dates for more sites, it turned out that there were people living in the Levant and in Mesopotamia, and really in all of the Near East, across the whole time from 7000 Cal BCE onwards, just like they had been there from before this collapse. Well, okay, maybe not exactly like they were living before. We do see some changes. The big one of these is that a lot of sites are abandoned. Or even where people are still there, they're only there in a small fraction of the numbers that they used to be. Instead, new villages turn up where there was no one living before. Not necessarily somewhere far away, but still somewhere new. And these villages are also generally smaller. We don't get the big settlements, the megasites, after this point. Actually, not to spoil it for you, but we won't be getting something like the megasites for a while after this point. I'm not going to say how long, though, because, well, spoilers. Because this is still a reasonably big change, there has continued to be a lot of research and speculation as to what happened across the Near East that caused this breakdown in the PPNB system. So we have a continuous line of decades of people looking into this collapse, trying to figure out what went wrong with the PPNB that made it end. Changes to the climate and stripping of the local landscape around sites were early contenders. And to some extent, these are still the big things that people look at to try to explain this collapse. One discovery a few decades ago caused a bit of a sensation, something that we call the 8.2 event. This is a climate event that would have caused changes in the Near East, making it drier for a couple of centuries. It's called the 8.2, but that's because paleoclimate specialists don't use BCE very much. Instead, they usually use calibrated years before present, or CalBP. So the 8.2 event happened about 8,200 years calibrated before present, or about 6,200 Cal BCE. You might have noticed the issue there. Yes, there was a noticeable climate event, but as we've gotten better at figuring out when this happened, and also when the end of the PPNB happened, we've realized that something happening about 6,200 Cal BCE was probably not the cause of something that happened about 7,000 Cal BCE. So, oops. Based on the reconstructions that we have of the climate in the Near East about 7,000 Cal BCE, such as from pollen extracted from lake cores or from the isotopic composition of cave stalagmites that grew during this time, it looks like 7,000 Cal BCE wasn't even a particularly dry time. It actually looks like it was a slightly wetter time in the early Holocene of the Near East, which in general was wetter than the climate that we get in this region today. So some sort of mega drought probably wasn't the smoking gun behind this collapse. This still leaves the stripping of soils and resources around sites as a potential cause. Some studies looking at the fragments of charcoal found on PPNB sites, which are either found as nice big pieces while digging or found in smaller pieces when doing flotation, which is that system of washing out excavated dirt that we use to find tiny things like seeds. These have suggested that big trees may have been in short supply on some of these sites, or that there are signs of deforestation in the region. Other studies, though, have shown the opposite, and suggested that the woodlands around sites were being actively managed to make sure that people had firewood and big trees for the long term. Where we do get evidence of what looks like deforestation, it isn't just limited to the later part of the PPNB, but we get it throughout the pre-pottery Neolithic sequence. Looking at the isotopes of the charred remains of crops found on the PPNB sites also doesn't really suggest that plants were getting increasingly starved of resources or nutrients over time. So while the idea that deforestation and the degradation of the landscape is still a pretty common reason which is given as to why the PPNB might have ended, studies looking to document this degradation of the landscape haven't really managed to add much support for this. This might be that we haven't been looking at the preserved charcoal or seeds in the right way. Or it could be that the idea of deforestation as causing the PPNB collapse will end up as one of those tidy little theories that actually do just turn out to be wrong. Actually, one of the big problems that we have in looking for the cause of the PPMB collapse is that a lot of archaeologists were trying to find an answer that would explain this change across all of the Near East. After all, we had pretty similar PPMB systems happening across many, or really most, parts of the Near East. So it makes sense that we would want to explain the end of the PPMB at that same big scale. Well, this is more complicated than that. The PPNB may have covered a big area, more or less as part of the same sort of system, but it doesn't end in the same way all over the place. This is actually what I think is the most interesting part of what we call the PPNB collapse. It isn't that it ends, it's that the Near East breaks up into a bunch of different patterns and different regions go in different directions. We've been mostly talking about the Near East as a single unit from the beginning of this podcast. There have been differences in some things, like stone tools, but similar processes have been at play across pretty much all of the Near East at about the same time. With the end of the PPNB, though, that changes. From this point on, we can't really talk about all of the Near East at once, as each region is doing much more of its own thing at any given point in time. There will be times in the future where different regions come together, and we have cultures and developments that span really big areas. But going forward, we'll be spending a lot more time looking at each region separately and comparing differences that happen in space as much as changes that happened across the Near East over time. You can think of the Near East like a baby, or maybe like a group of babies. Babies have their own personalities, but mostly they want to eat, sleep, and go potty. As they grow up, they start to form more of their own individual personalities, and they start to go their own separate ways in the way that they think and act. If we think of it this way, then we can think of the regions in the Near East as starting to grow up and develop their own personalities. Different regions may still be friends, and they might have a lot in common, but they won't necessarily be identical, and they won't necessarily be close friends with all of the other regions. To give you an idea, I want to talk today about some of the changes that we see from about 7000 Cal BCE in two regions of the Near East. I will come back later and have a look at the other regions as well. But for now, I think that looking at changes in the southern Levant and northern Mesopotamia make for pretty interesting examples of how the end of the PPNB really isn't just one thing. In the southern Levant, the end of the PPNB from about 7000 Cal BCE isn't the end of the pre-pottery Neolithic. It's actually the start of a final phase of the pre-pottery Neolithic called the PPNC. So we don't really have pottery yet. Well, actually, we don't have people using pottery a lot as an everyday thing. But we have actually had pottery in the southern Levant for a little while already. Yes, we've been in the pre-pottery Neolithic, but as it turns out, this name isn't quite as clear as I've been pretending. It's not just me, though. All of archaeology talks about the pre-pottery Neolithic or the aceramic Neolithic in the uncomfortable knowledge that it would be much more accurate to call it the very little and infrequently used pottery Neolithic. But that sounds terrible, and anyway, we've all gotten used to calling it the PPN before we realized that this wasn't strictly true. We've had some use of clay in a way that's not quite pottery since the beginning of the pre-pottery Neolithic. Mainly people coating fireplaces and ovens in clay and mud, which then gets fired a bit and preserves. That's burned clay, but not necessarily pottery. We also have some examples of mud and clay being shaped into storage bins, with slabs of clay flattened out and stood up together to form an unbaked, dried mud container for household storage. This sometimes gets burned in a house fire, and then we find the clay bins preserved. If they didn't get burned, then these would have just gone right back into dirt as the house got buried over time. So we don't actually know how common this sort of use of clay was in the pre-pottery Neolithic. We also have figurines at some sites, made out of fired clay. Sometimes it looks like these were just made as dried clay figurines, as in, there was never any real intention to bake them, and they got fired by accident. And sometimes they do seem to have been intentionally fired. So this gives us ceramics, fired clay, but not necessarily pottery. Then we have the hardest category to ignore, actual pottery. This seems to have been very rare. I say that it seems to have been because we're not actually all that sure. The best example that we have for now of pottery from the pre-pottery Neolithic comes from the middle PPNB site of Kfar HaHoresh in the southern Levant. This might have been a settlement, although excavations here so far haven't really found any houses. What we mostly have at Kfar HaHoresh is graves. The best idea that we have at the moment is that this was a place where people came to bury their dead, have funerals, and maybe have other rituals as well, but they were probably living at other settlements in the area and not living directly on this site. Kfar HaHoresh also stopped being used at the end of the MPPNB, and no one ever put a settlement on top of it in the future. So when the archaeologists excavating the site found some pottery sherds, archaeologists call fragments of pottery sherds as the official term. So when the excavators found sherds during the excavation of this site, it was pretty clear that these were from the PPNB, and they weren't just accidentally mixed in from a later occupation. This isn't just one or two either. They found at least 23 of these in very good contexts, based on the publication of these from a few years ago, so they might have even more by now. And, like I said, they have been found in very clear and secure contexts, so we know that they were not mixed in. Now, these are pieces of pottery, but you probably should not be thinking of something like fine porcelain. They're not completely blank. At least one of them seems to have been painted red with ochre. But they are mostly thick pieces of pretty vague pottery shapes. They've not been fired to a very high temperature, which means that they're more fragile, and they haven't broken into actually pretty small pieces. More like something that can easily fit into the palm of your hand. The fact that they're pretty thick means that they would have been likely to crack up during the firing process unless some sort of temper was added into the mix. Microscopic studies of these sherds has shown that, indeed, vegetable matter was added into the clay to keep it from cracking. The fact that this vegetable matter contains spherulites, which are something that you get in the poo of ruminants, like sheep, goats, and cattle, means that the clay was probably mixed with animal poo to stabilize it. So while we do have this lovely early pottery, we unfortunately have to contend with the fact that, yes, it is made partially out of poop. Sorry about that. But at least we are not the ones cooking and eating out of these pots. Or at least if they were pots. These could have been something like serving platters, but with such tiny pieces, it's actually kind of hard to tell. Most of these sherds come from clays that are available near the site, so they can be considered something that was made locally. Two pieces, though, are made from different types of clay, which suggests that at least one other site, probably somewhere in the southern Levant, was also occasionally making pottery. It's hard to tell whether this was something almost unique to Kfar HaHoresh, or if it was something that was rare but was happening all over the southern Levant, or maybe all over the Near East. Because we weren't exactly expecting to find pottery in the pre-pottery Neolithic. And if little pieces did turn up in the past on PPNB sites, people might have just assumed that they came from later occupation sequences and had fallen in or been mixed in. So there is a certain amount of embarrassed shuffling, as everyone who has ever dug a pre-pottery Neolithic site tries desperately to remember if they ever threw away a contaminating piece of pottery. If so, it's a little bit late now, but at least we'll know to keep an eye out in future. Hopefully. The PPNC, though, is not a time when pottery begins to turn up across site to the southern Levant. It's as much of a non-pottery part of the Neolithic as the PPNB was. At the same time, the PPNC is not the PPNB. After all, we gave it a different name for a reason. The megasites disappear, for starters. Either everyone has left these big sites, or where we do find people living there in the PPNC, it's in smaller groups, living in more dispersed houses. While this is a pretty distinct change, it actually isn't really just a change of the PPNC. At the end of the middle PPNB, a couple hundred years before this, we see some sites in the southern Levant that also got abandoned, and new sites being founded in the late PPNB. So while the abandonment of a lot of the megasites and other villages and the foundation of new villages in the PPNC is interesting, it can also be seen as a bigger version of something that had been happening already. After all, not all villages last forever. If they did, then they'd be a lot easier to find, as we would still be living there now. Something that does seem to be new about the PPNC is that the trade networks for obsidian and stone beads seem to have kind of gone. Although whether this is because the megasites have gone, or whether the trade routes fell apart first, and then people left the megasites, is still a question. What we see instead of the megasites is mostly people moving off to settle in new areas. Although, like I said, some of the old megasites still have smaller populations living on them. Instead of the dense clusters of similar houses built up together with communal buildings in between them, we start to see a different sort of layout. At some sites, we still get houses that look a lot like the ones that we had in the late part of the PPNB, although these do tend to be more spread out rather than squished tight together like they were before. In between the houses, we might have bare open space, or sometimes they might find storage pits or little storage structures, or sometimes what looks like an area that was fenced off as an animal pen or a courtyard. In some cases, it looks like what we have are a few houses arranged along different sides of a courtyard, with storage pits or storage structures in between them. Presumably, if these houses were set up around a shared courtyard, with several sets of these houses and courtyards in the village, we would expect that we're either looking at one large family using several houses for different purposes, or that the houses were occupied by different families who were somehow connected to one another, such as groups of friends or extended families. As far as the public buildings that we saw in the PPNB, we might still have these, but the smaller settlements of the PPNC and the changes to the layout of the houses has made it harder to be sure if we found a public building or maybe just a slightly larger house. At the moment, though, it doesn't really look like the villages of the PPNC Southern Levant had public buildings in them, or at least not ones which look different enough from the houses for us to be sure. Something else that we see coming in the PPNC and the Southern Levant is the presence of these villages along the shoreline. Now, the sea level in the Mediterranean at about 7,000 Cal BCE was 20 meters lower than it is today, or about 60 feet. So villages which were along the coast then are mostly underwater now. Archaeologists have found a few of these over the last couple of decades, which are hiding just a meter or so underwater, just off the coast. These not only suggest that at least some people were starting to make better use of the sea, but it also gives us some of the first evidence that we have in the Southern Levant for the digging of wells, which seems to begin here in the PPNC. We've seen wells already at sites in other parts of the Near East from earlier on in the pre-pottery Neolithic, such as the ones that we had in Cyprus, but they don't really seem to have been much of a thing in the Southern Levant before the PPNC. This might relate to these villages along the coast being placed so that they had good access to coastal fishing areas, and maybe were not necessarily chosen because they had good access to springs or rivers, meaning that the villagers needed to dig down to get a nearby source of fresh drinking water. Of course, the sea level didn't just rise between the PPNC and now. It also rose over the course of the PPNB. This means that if there were coastal fishing villages in the Levant during the PPNB, they're probably farther underwater today than the ones from the PPNC, and they haven't been found yet. Archaeologists have realized this, though, and there has been work done looking for buried underwater villages. So far, though, none of the ones that have been found are earlier than the PPNC. So, at the moment, this is when we think that these types of settlements were starting to become a normal part of the landscape. We also see some changes in the technology that people were using to make stone tools. Naviform blade technology, our old friend throughout the PPNB, goes out of fashion in the Southern Levant as we get into the PPNC. Instead, people start making their stone tools using unidirectional flake and blade technology, and they start using a lot more flakes and flake tools rather than the earlier emphasis on mostly blades. We also start to see these flakes and blades getting something called pressure retouch. This means that instead of hitting the rock with a stone hammer to break off more pieces, you apply pressure with a stone hammer or with a piece of antler at a chosen point so that the increasing pressure gently pings off a tiny sliver of stone from the edge. This was used particularly on sickles, the tools used to harvest plants. And from this retouch, people were able to give them a serrated edge like a saw. This sort of serrated edge on a blade, such as a sickle, is called a denticulated blade, with denticulated referring to the blades looking like they have a row of teeth. Apart from the village layouts and stone tool technology, the main thing that we see in the Southern Levant and the PPNC is a continuation of the farming that we saw in the PPNB. We now have people with a good range of fully domesticated plants and animals, And as far as we can tell, it looks like people over the course of the PPNC were generally spending less time hunting wild animals and gathering wild plants than they did during the PPNB. This was not necessarily a sharp change, though. When people got up one day and decided, now that they had changed the style of their houses and gotten some more fashionable-looking tools, they were not going to go out wandering around the landscape like Grandpa did. It's still a bit hard to be clear, but it actually looks like this was the end part of a more gradual process of less and less hunting and gathering, which started to happen in the later parts of the PPNB. So the PPNC in the Southern Levant is actually pretty different from the PPNB. While we can't really think of a catastrophic collapse of society, we do see the loss of a lot of the long-distance movement of goodies, and we lose the megasites. I suppose that it is fairly dramatic if we're looking from the old megasites to these little villages. But then again, people also lived in little villages all through the PPNB. Not everyone lived only at the megasites, after all. What we've mostly lost then, apart from a few big sites, is the ties into the regional networks with the rest of the Near East. Of course, while we can look through the archaeological record and see the drop-off in obsidian and other goodies moving long distances, I don't know if your average PPNZ farmer would have necessarily noticed such a big difference. We're also talking about something that happened over the course of a few centuries. It's not like everyone got up one day and decided to move house. So this might have been a pretty dramatic time of change. Or it might have just been a slower process of individual families or groups of families deciding to leave the hustle and bustle of the megasite and to strike out for a quiet place in the country where they could have more open space to themselves. Of course, the Southern Levant is only one part of the Near East. What we see happening here after about 7,000 Cal BCE isn't necessarily the same as what happened in other parts of the Near East. In northern Mesopotamia, for example, we get pretty much the opposite of what we see in the Southern Levant. Here, what we see is the earliest pottery turning up from about 7,000 Cal BCE. Unlike with the MPPNB sherds that were found at Kfar HaHoresh, in northern Mesopotamia, we find large enough pieces to have a general idea of what these pottery vessels look like. What they looked like in terms of shape was pretty basic, with mostly bowl and jug shapes. Think of something like soup bowls, serving bowls, or maybe large mugs. Once we get away from shape, though, they stop being basic. The earliest pottery that we see in northern Mesopotamia, from sites like Tel Sabi Abyad, is well made. The walls of the pots are regular and even, and they're made out of clay which has lots of mineral pieces mixed into it, which means that the people living here were able to get past the issue of pots cracking up during the firing process without having to mix in vegetable matter. So these pots were not only really nice looking, but poo-free. There does also seem to have been some effort put in to making these nice looking too. There is a technique called burnishing that you can use with pottery. This basically means that you take the dried pot before it's fired and you polish the surface, either on the inside or on the outside or both. It's up to you. This not only makes the pot look nice and smooth, but it also evens out some of the pores so it doesn't absorb as much water. And once it's fired, it makes the surface nice and shiny. The earliest pottery at Sabi Abyad, from what's called the initial pottery Neolithic, which runs from about 7,000 to 6,700 Cal BCE, so not that long, this pottery is often burnished. In addition to a smooth and shiny burnished finish, some of the pots are also decorated with painted stripes or zigzag lines. So this is very early pottery, but we can't really think of it as primitive. The people making pottery in the initial pottery Neolithic of northern Mesopotamia seem to have known what they were doing, which suggests that the pottery may have been around for a bit in the area before this, or that the people making the pottery put a lot of effort into figuring out this new technology to get the pots not only to work, but to look nice while they did it. It's hard to tell which of these options is what happened, because while the pottery is very pretty, it still wasn't super common, and we don't get huge amounts of sherds coming out of initial pottery Neolithic sites. It's also not all that easy to date the start of people using pottery in northern Mesopotamia, and to separate the initial pottery Neolithic from the end of the PPNB. This is because of something that northern Mesopotamia really does not have in common with the Southern Levant. Where the Southern Levant did not have pottery turning up in these first few hundred years after 7,000 Cal BCE, but had a lot of changes to where people were living and how they were making things, northern Mesopotamia does have pottery turning up, but nothing else seems to change. The houses at initial Pottery Neolithic sites, like Tel Sabi Abiad, look just like the ones from the later part of the PPMB. Sites where we have found initial Pottery Neolithic layers also were almost always occupied already in the PPNB, and people continued to live there from the PPNB through the initial Pottery Neolithic, and they were still there afterwards. So we don't have this widespread abandonment of sites and finding sites in new areas like we got in the southern Levant. We also don't really see changes in the architecture, or how the houses were clustered together, or really much of anything else. At some sites, like at Tel Halula, we actually have these initial Pottery Neolithic pieces of pottery starting to turn up in the very last layers of the PPNB. So this can be thought of as a gradual change of the same people, using the same things, living in the same way, and just adding in some pots. We do see some use of pressure flaking in the way that the stone tools were made. But here in northern Mesopotamia, pressure flaking was around a bit already in the PPNB, even if most of the stone tools were not made this way. So even the use of a different technique for making stone tools wasn't a new technique like we see in the southern Levant, so much as a slightly greater popularity of something that was already around. As far as the trade of goodies over long distances, this is a little bit harder to figure out from northern Mesopotamia, as this region is pretty close to the obsidian sources in Anatolia, which were traded around in the PPNB. And they were already getting a fair amount of this obsidian, even in the PPNA. So northern Mesopotamia lost out a bit less on the collapse of the PPNB. They lost out so much less, in fact, that there isn't really any collapse at all. At least, not yet. We will have a look at the changes from the pre-Pottery Neolithic and the beginning of the late or Pottery Neolithic in other parts of the Near East in future episodes. But even in the regions that I've left out here, we don't necessarily see a big systematic collapse of society. Even where things do show a pretty noticeable change, this doesn't happen in the same way, and it doesn't necessarily happen at the same time across the Near East. So while we do see the big system of PPMB similarity across much of the Near East breaking up and fragmenting into different patterns in different regions, I'm not really sure if we should think of this as a collapse. We know that there was variation already between the regions in the PPNB, and even in the PPNA. After the pre-Pottery Neolithic, we just have the regional variation that we had before, only a lot more of it. The Near East was growing up, and the regions were developing more distinct personalities. Rather than seeing this as some sort of calamitous collapse, we should probably instead just think of this as an exciting time of local development, and enjoy the range of new societies as each region went in their own separate ways. Thank you for listening to the Prehistory Podcast. If you have any questions or comments, you can reach me at prehistorypodcast@gmail.com. If you'd like to see some of the pottery, houses, or denticulated blades that I've talked about today, you can find these on the website at prehistorypodcast.com. If you have enjoyed this episode, please give the podcast a rating and a review on your platform of choice to help others find it. And come back and join us next time, when we'll start looking at some of these new and more local societies that developed around the Near East as we move into the late or Pottery Neolithic.